assume you've all had an opportunity to look at our written statements of procedures. We'd ask anybody in the audience that has a cell phone or similar device to please turn it off so the lawyers aren't interrupted. Otherwise, we're ready for argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Alan Epstein representing Grandoti Golf and Tennis Club. The first issue plaintiff raises on appeal is whether the trial court incorrectly concluded that the statute of limitations barred plaintiff's claim for declaratory relief. Annexation Ordinance 131, promulgated by the town of La Vida in 1984, annexed the subject property to include it within the town's boundaries. In 1985, the town promulgated Ordinance 144, which purported to disconnect the property. Plaintiff's declaratory relief action sought a declaration that Ordinance 144 was invalid because the town did not comply with the disconnect requirements of CRS 3112501 and 2432109. The town moved to dismiss plaintiff's complaint, arguing that the two-year statute of limitations barred it because it was not brought within 2 years of the enactment of Ordinance 144. The town's subsequent briefing converted its motion to dismiss into a motion for summary judgment because it addressed matters outside the pleadings. The trial court first ruled that the plaintiff's complaint was barred because it was not brought within 2 years of Ordinance 144's effective date in 1985. This ruling was incorrect as a matter of law. In Harrison v. Pinnacle Assurance, the Court of Appeals held that the two-year statute of limitations under 1380-101-102-1I applied to complaints for declaratory relief. The court also held that the statute of limitations began to run when the plaintiff discovered or should have discovered the damage giving rise to the cause of action.
So what is the damage here?
The damage is that the Grandoti believes that it is within town boundaries because 144 was ineffective, 131 was effective, so that it is contained within the boundaries of the city, of the town.
I understand that, but what's the damage? I mean, why are we here? Is it a denial of services? I mean, what is going on?
Frankly, I'm not positive what the motivation is, but it is a question of services. Exactly what they are, I'm not sure, but it is the desire of Grandoti to be considered within the town boundaries. It has paid taxes the entire time it's owned the property, and I believe it is a matter of having services extended by the town to Grandoti.
And there wasn't a claim of estoppel against the municipality in connection with the payment and receipt of the taxes?
There was not. It is not, I don't believe it's a matter of the appellate record. Subsequent to the appeal being initiated, the town tendered back to Grandoti the taxes that were paid, they weren't accepted. They may be in escrow at this point. I can't remember, but they were tendered back by the town to Grandoti, but not accepted. Plaintiff's complaint alleged that it purchased the property in 2002 and that it became aware in the fall of 2008 of the town's failure to comply with the statutory requirements necessary to effect a disconnect. Plaintiff's complaint was filed in May of 2009, and it was therefore, we contend, timely. Under the trial court's reasoning, all challenges to the validity of statutes or ordinances must be brought within 2 years of their enactment, regardless of when the plaintiff was injured or learned of the injury, or, as in this case, even existed when the statute began to run. but legislation is challenged all the time, long after its enactment, depending on when and how it impacts a plaintiff. No authority supports the trial court's reasoning that implicit reasoning that the discovery rule does not apply to declaratory judgment actions challenging the validity of statutes or ordinances. The court's ruling effectively converted the statute of limitations into a statute of repose applicable only to legislative challenges. Last week, the town filed supplemental authorities, which it, I assume, purports to support its argument that the statute began to run on the date of its enactment. Grandoti moved to strike on the basis that it did not comply with Rule 28 because the authority was not new. That, my understanding is that motion is pending, but to the extent the court is considering those authorities, plaintiff contends that they are easily distinguishable. First, they all say that the discovery rule does apply to constitutional challenges to legislation. Some of them say that a facial challenge begins to run when the statute is enacted, while an as-applied challenge begins to run when the statute is applied. None of them hold that the statute begins to run before the plaintiff is injured or even exists, as in this case. And plaintiff here is not challenging the facial constitutionality of Ordinance 144. It was facially valid. Plaintiff is challenging whether it ever became effective because it was not properly statutorily implemented. And none of the cases in plaintiff's supplemental authorities address this scenario.
Trial court. Mr. Epstein, so with respect to 144, you concede that it was validly enacted, but the dispute is whether, despite being validly enacted, it was ever effective because of the statutory requirements.
Yes, okay. That is exactly our position. The trial court ruled in the affirmative, that Ordinance 144 disconnected the property because the parties and their predecessors subjectively believed that it did. And this ruling was also incorrect as a matter of law. The trial court reasoned that the parties understood that Ordinance 131 had been repealed by 144 because Ordinance 154, which re-annexed part of the property, would not have been enacted otherwise. Ordinance 154, however, was promulgated in 1987 before plaintiff owned the property. Therefore, as a practical matter, plaintiff could not have understood Ordinance 144 to have effectively repealed Ordinance 131. But more importantly, whether legislation is valid or effective is a legal question subject to de novo review. The party's subjective understanding is not a factor in that consideration. The trial court's ruling cites no authority to support its reasoning that the party's subjective understanding controlled whether 144 repealed 131, and the town's answer brief does not cite any such authority. The trial court also referred to an answer that plaintiff filed in a recent lawsuit relating to the maintenance of streets in a town, in the town subdivision, or a town subdivision, as support for the proposition plaintiff understood Ordinance 131 to have been repealed by 144. But the answer plaintiff filed in that suit was in the spring of 08. And plaintiff alleged that it did not learn of the defective implementation of Ordinance 144 until the fall of 08.
Mr. Epstein, why is it the defective implementation that triggers the running of the statute? Why isn't it your client's knowledge that it is not receiving services from the town? It claims it's within the town. The town won't provide services. That seems to be the damage here. Why doesn't the statute begin running then?
Well, that would be a fact question.
I understand that. I'm just trying to figure out what the trigger is here. Is it knowledge of this ineffective enactment, as you contend, or is it knowledge that the town is not providing services that your client thinks it's entitled to?
Well, it's my understanding, and this is in the context of a dispositive pleading, that Grandoni did not become aware until it went to the clerk and recorder's office and saw that these statutory procedures were not complied with, and that may. I'm not sure whether that would be an issue. It might be, but it's not in this proceeding because it wasn't pled. It wasn't pled in the complaint. It wasn't pled in the motion to dismiss, and it wasn't pled by the town. What you're suggesting wasn't pled by the town as a response to Grandoni's argument in the context of the summary judgment proceeding that the town had turned this into after bringing in other matters outside the pleadings. It didn't bring that in. Whether that could become an issue, I don't know. And when that knowledge, when Grandoni acquired that knowledge, if it did, I don't know that either. But it isn't an issue here.
Does the record here tell us whether these various ordinances are in the chain of title of the property that Grandoni bought?
Whether the ordinances are
in other words, if a city enacts an ordinance annexing property, is that ordinance then automatically recorded in a manner so that everybody who buys a piece of the property will see it in the chain of title? Do we know that from the record?
We don't know that from the
record. Okay, thank you.
Finally, plaintiff contends that the trial court should have determined that Ordinance 144 was ineffective to repeal Ordinance 131 and disconnect the property because the town did not comply with 31.12.501 and 24.32.109. The petition to repeal Ordinance 131 did not allege present ownership or describe the subject property. No finding was made by the town board that the best interests of the town would not be prejudiced by the disconnect. Neither the petition nor the ordinance nor Ordinance 144 contains a legal description or map, and the ordinance was not filed with the Huerfano County Clerk and Recorder at all. The town argues that it did not have to comply with these statutes because Ordinance 144 was not a disconnect ordinance. The town argues it wasn't a disconnect ordinance because Ordinance 131 did not annex the property in the first instance. But this is a circular argument because if Ordinance 131 did not annex the property, then Ordinance 144 served no purpose. But Ordinance 131 did annex the property. There's never been a judicial determination that 131 was ineffective to annex the property. Although litigation was initiated that challenged Ordinance 131, that litigation settled. The town did not affirmatively seek a declaratory judgment that Ordinance 131 was invalid or ineffective, and it's essentially seeking that relief that from the trial court and this court as a defense to plaintiff's complaint. I would suggest that is procedurally improper. And in any event, the defects the town cites in contending that Ordinance 131 was ineffective in annexing the property were de minimis. Ordinance 131 and a map of the property were filed with the clerk and recorder under 31.12.113.2A. Only a duplicate wasn't. The town also argues that 131 was ineffective under 24.32.109 because the clerk and recorder did not file a duplicate copy with the Department of Local Affairs. But the purpose of this duplicate filing, the town contends, was for the administration and collection of taxes, and in fact the county assessor assessed and plaintiff paid taxes on the property described in Ordinance 131.
Did you agree that there was a failure of the DOLA filing requirement?
There was not a duplicate of the ordinance filed. Only one certified copy was filed.
And that's with the county clerk and recorder, but no copy was filed with the Department of Local Affairs.
The statute, I believe, imposes the obligation of filing the duplicate on the county clerk and recorder, and that wasn't accomplished. But the purpose of the filing was for the implementation of taxes, and the county assessor to assess taxes.
Talking about the filing with the Department
of Local Affairs.
Local Affairs.
I believe the statute says that the clerk and recorder is to do that, is to file the duplicate.
That was not.
And that was not done. I believe that the record shows.
But the Department of Local Affairs, they don't get a copy for tax. They get a copy because they're supposed to maintain these records so that anybody who's concerned about where the boundaries of a municipality are or can look at the records and find out.
What the purpose of it is not clear from my reading of the statute, and the town argued that a duplicate was supposed to be filed with the Department of Local Affairs. I don't believe that entity is named in the statute. That is what the town argued, and the town argued that the purpose of the filing with the Department of Local Affairs was for the maintenance of tax or for the imposition of taxes. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Larry Berkowitz appearing on behalf of the appellee town of La Vida. I'm with the law firm of Grimshaw and Herring. My registration number is 883 and I'm not 150 years old. Also with me today is Thomas George, associate in the firm of Grimshaw and Herring. His registration number is 41395. As stated by the trial court, this action concerns the construction and validity of certain ordinances of the town of La Vida between 1984 and 1987 relating to annexation. The trial court dismissed the action based on the statute of limitation provisions 1380.102.1H and I, H being the challenges to governmental actions have to be brought within 2 years, and I being the catch-all provision that this court applied to declaratory judgment actions. There are three ordinances involved here. And as you know, ordinances are presumed valid. The three town ordinances involved are Ordinance 131, 144, and 154. There is no challenge to Ordinance number 131 or 154, and I was surprised to hear this morning, or just now, that apparently the appellant is not challenging 144 anymore, although the complaint and the briefs clearly say that they were asking for a declaration that 144 was a void and of no effect. This is clearly a facial challenge to the ordinance. This court, the Supreme Court, has not addressed the issue of statute of limitations as it applies to a facial challenge to a piece of legislation. And we would submit that the Pinnacle Assurance case is not on all points with this. This is a different situation. As you know, Pinnacle Assurance was an allocation of workers' compensation benefits, and that is not the case here. And the purpose of the additional citations which we were provided to the court were in response to the argument that there is no statute of limitations that applies to constitutional claims. Clearly, that is not the case, and those cases held, the ones that were applicable, held that a statute of limitations does apply to facial challenges to legislation from the date the legislation became effective. We have a lot of terminology in this case, and some of it gets a little confusing. Not only are we talking about timeliness of a challenge to municipal ordinances, we're also talking about the terms valid and effective. And those terms get kind of mixed up in some of these statutes. It's the town's position that all of these ordinances were effective, including 144. The action contemplated by 144 was effective. It said it was going to repeal Ordinance 131. Both of those ordinances were valid. The distinction here is whether or not the actions that they authorized or directed were carried out. 131 was a validly adopted, passed, and published ordinance that became effective as an ordinance 30 days after it was published. But he directed that an annexation occur, and under the annexation laws, and under other state statutes, namely 3112.113 and section 2432.109, we know that an annexation just doesn't occur by the mere passage of an ordinance. Certain things have to happen. Certain filings have to be made. At the time that this annexation occurred, the map and a legal description and notification of the annexation had to be filed with the municipal clerk and the county clerk, and then the county clerk had to file another copy of the ordinance in the map with the Division of Local Affairs, the Division of Local Government, and those agencies are specifically mentioned in the statutes. Now, there's no dispute that those actions were not taken with regard to 131. Thereafter, a lawsuit is filed against the town by the previous owner of Grand Doty, saying they want a mandamus action directing that the town take actions necessary to complete the annexation. Discussions were held among between the town and the property owner, and there was a decision to dismiss the lawsuit and reconsider the annexation at a later time. So 144 was adopted. And to the extent, 144 is not a model of clear language. There is definitely surplusage in that ordinance that shouldn't be there. The ordinance says it is going to repeal 131 and disconnect the property. The property was never connected. So 144 says very clearly it repeals ordinance 131. To the extent there's any ambiguity in 144 or what was done, we would suggest that the minutes of the town board meeting that you have in the record at CD 49 and 50, where the mayor indicates that when they were considering rule ordinance 144, he says to the town board, you understand if we adopt 144, we're going to be repealing 131. Since the annexation had never been effective, even though the ordinance was effective, the annexation was never effective under 131, they agreed to repeal it, and that was all that was necessary. So the language about disconnection is mere surplusage.
Why isn't the city stopped from disavowing the annexation, at least as to Grand Doty, by virtue of having assessed taxes on Grand Doty for several years?
Well, in the first place, I don't know that all taxes were assessed, but secondly, the remedy for improper payment of taxes falls under section, the statutes under section 39-10-114. If they now allege they were paying taxes improperly, the process is to go and file for an abatement and a refund. That is not handled through the town.
Mr. Berkowitz, the question isn't what remedy is available to the taxpayer. The question is what actions taken by the city now stop it from denying that there was an effective annexation?
The city passed ordinance number 131 never affected the annexation. The statutes that we've referred to, 3112.113 and 2432.109, are very clear that no annexation occurs unless these actions are taken. Those actions were not taken, so an annexation didn't occur. 144 repealed 131, so I'm not sure that estoppel comes into play in this case. There was no detrimental reliance by the appellant. There was no representation by the town upon which the appellant relied. I'm not sure, and I don't see how estoppel would apply.
Bill for taxes, a representation, and isn't the payment of taxes reliance on it?
The bill for taxes is not sent by the town, Your Honor. Bill for taxes is sent by the county. The town wouldn't even know that the tax bill was being sent.
So does the county then remit taxes to the town? How does that work?
Yes.
And
the county remits the taxes to the town.
How does
the extent there was a property tax mill levy, and I don't even know if there was.
Okay, and so I guess what we're all wondering is what happened here. Apparently, the county thought the property had been annexed by 131.
They've submitted an affidavit. Why they come up with that understanding, I have absolutely no idea.
Well, perhaps because a copy of the ordinance was filed with the county.
That's possible. LaVita's position, by the way, if we're talking about the discovery rule, what the appellant says is that it discovered that 144 was invalid, and that's what led to its discovery of its claims here. But 144 was not invalid, and now it says, and they acknowledge, that 144 was validly adopted. If 144 was validly adopted, then their discovery was knocked out. Furthermore, their statement about discovering this problem is belied by the statements they made in the last lawsuit that was brought.
I think I understood Mr. Epstein to say that 144 was not effective.
It absolutely was effective. It was adopted, it was passed, and it was published, and that is not challenged. And you have the affidavits of publication in the record, and the court found it to have been a validly adopted and valid ordinance.
What purpose did it serve?
It repealed ordinance number 131.
But if 131 was never effective, as you say, from the get-go, what was the point of repealing?
Absolutely none.
So 144 served no purpose.
If 131 is invalid, then we don't need to be here.
Well, I'm not saying not invalid, but just ineffective to annex the property. It's validly passed. You have it on the books. But 144 repeals it. Why is the repeal necessary to accomplish, or what is it necessary to accomplish?
It was what the parties had agreed to do based upon and following the lawsuit that was filed. The previous property owner sued the town asking the court to direct the town to make the additional filings. They subsequently had some discussions. They say that there were misunderstandings about the annexation, so they repealed 131, which perhaps they didn't need to if the annexation hadn't occurred. But then they proceeded to adopt ordinance number 154, which annexed a significant portion of the property, approximately 91 acres. And after it had been zoned and subdivided by the county, the county, after 144 was adopted, then the property owner went back to the county, to Wharfedale County, and said, we'd like you to subdivide our property. We'd like you to zone our property. And in fact, the agreement with the town was, after the county zones and subdivides your property, we will annex it. And that's what occurred through 154. Subsequently, properties were sold pursuant to 154 and the subdivision plat that had been approved by the county. Now, if the county was so clear that this property was in LaVita after 131, why did the county undertake subdivision and zoning approval? They had no authority and no jurisdiction to do so. But everyone relied on that subdivision and zoning approval by the county that occurred after 144 was passed and 131 was repealed.
Was 144 a condition of settlement of the initial lawsuit? Is that in the record?
It's true. We believe it's part of the record. It's not absolutely clear, but minutes of small towns hardly ever are. In the July 16th minutes, it's July 16th, 1985, and that's at the record at, CD 63 and 65. The town, and this is before, obviously, 144 was adopted. The town says that members, representatives of Grand Doty were there, and it says, let the minutes reflect that the principal people involved in Grand Doty agreed to drop the lawsuit against the town prior to July 17th at 1:30 p.m., and the town board does agree that if an agreement cannot be reached through further negotiations with Grand Doty, that a reapplication for disconnection from the town of LaVita will be approved. Again, we have the inartful words disconnection. Then that the lawsuit is dismissed 6 days later. A search of the record in that lawsuit doesn't contain the motion, the joint motion for dismissal. That's gone. But then again, on August 6, 1985, at the time 144 was being considered, Mayor Mayfield read to the board ordinance number 144, which if passed would repeal ordinance number 131.
Let's turn to the statute of limitations issue. I have a question about this trigger. You know, when does it start to run? And as you know, the court ruled that it simply began to run when it was enacted, when the ordinance was enacted in 1985. And I'm wondering how that can be. I was living in Colorado in 1985, but I wasn't within the county or within this, living within the property. If I had instituted an action within the 2 years of 1985 to have my property declared part of the town or not, wouldn't I have been kicked out of court for lack of standing? I mean, how can you say the statute's run as to someone who doesn't even have standing to bring a lawsuit?
If you had bought property in the town?
No. Grand Doty didn't exist in 1985. All right. So, but let's assume that it existed but didn't own property. It couldn't have filed an action to have the annexation declared valid or invalid. It wouldn't have standing to do that. It didn't buy property. It didn't even have it didn't even have standing until 2002 when it bought the property. How can the statute begin to run before it even has standing?
Because it's a facial challenge to the ordinance.
But we have facial challenges all the time to statutes that have been on the books for decades. We don't say you're out of court because, I mean, you may not have even been alive when it was passed.
You don't, in an as-applied challenge, they would still have standing. But if it's a facial challenge to the ordinance, it's our position that their time limit would run out 2 years after the time the ordinance became at the time the ordinance became effective.
So the time runs as to a party that doesn't even exist.
That's correct.
All right. I got to tell you, I don't see any case that says that, and it doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, how can that be? Well, if you can't possibly bring the action, how can the statute limit? It's not a statute of repose. It's a statute of limitations. There's a big difference there.
In this case, we don't even think that applies because of the actions of the appellant and what their statements were. They acknowledged in the last lawsuit that they brought against the town that, in fact, the property at the time of that lawsuit, Grand Doty 1, was located adjacent to the southern boundary of the town. And then they further went on and said that the annexation of Grand Doty 1 occurred on October 6, 1987. And that's in the last lawsuit they filed, case number 2008 CV16.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Time's exhausted. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Since this is the only case on our docket this afternoon, the bailiff may announce a recess.
Recess subject to call.